I was privileged today to speak with our share tonight. His name is Larry Gaines, and it's I love it when I get to meet people from other parts of the country. And he found sobriety on July 9th, 1982 in Little Rock, Arkansas. I always say Arkansas, just to remember how to spell it, but it's also known as Arkansas. And even that's where he was born as well. And you know, something funny about 1982 is I think that would be my seventh grade year, and I think that was the year I took my first drink. I think. I don't remember the exact time. But he was sharing with me who his first sponsor was, this guy named Joe. And then Joe passed away, you know, back in 2007, and he shared with me his second sponsor, and that was Charlie. And I'm thinking, where have I heard these guys' names before? Where did this come from? And then he put it together. Yeah, that's Joe and Charlie. And I'm like, oh, man. They got tapes on YouTube and recovery all over the place. And what a blessing to meet somebody who has actually met those guys. And even Clancy. So if you could we please give a warm Valley Group welcome to Larry Gaines from Arkansas.
Thank you. As you said, my name is Larry, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Larry.
I'm going to do something before I start. First of all, I want to thank God. I want to thank good sponsorship in the Valley Group for inviting me. But I also want to draw a brief attention, even though people say you're not supposed to talk about personalities, but you know that Clancy was a giant in Alcoholics Anonymous, just like Joe and Charlie was. And we have to briefly mention him, because Clancy came to Little Rock numerous times to visit Joe, and we had him speaking there. So that's all I'm going to say. He's going to be sorely missed. He was a very, very special alcoholic. With that said, as Jim said, I was born and raised here in Little Rock, Arkansas. And obviously, back in the 50s, the United States is pretty, difficult place for some people to be raised in. But however, with that, I talk about, my sponsors that I had was divinely chose for me. And Joe's my second sponsor, but my first sponsor was a guy named Gene Gibbons, and he was the guy that had been in the penitentiary from all the way from Rikers Island to Sing Sing, all the way across the nation. And Joe sponsored him. That's how I met Joe. And I look back on it on my life and see how God orchestrated everything that happened to me up until now, to the moment that I'm speaking right now. And that's the fact that he put these people in my life. I used to think that the reason that he put these people in my life was that I was, a pretty bad character. But I look now and I see I was pretty sick. So he kind of put some good people in my life. And I took my first drink when I was 6 years old. As the readings was being read about what an alcoholic was and everything, my first drink was 6 years old. My father gave me a cap of Italian Swiss Colony wine. And I tasted that wine, and he put the cap back on it, and he put the bottle up. It was summertime. I never forget it. I could vividly see it in my memory now when I took that little sip of wine. I kept sneaking back in there drinking the wine, putting the cap back on, drinking the wine, putting the cap back on. And for years, for 26 years, I thought that the reason that I was drinking that wine was because of the taste. I knew nothing about what an alcoholic was. But until I attended one of Joe's Monday night meetings, and he was explaining the first step, and he was talking about what was normal and what was abnormal, the difference between an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic. Well, I like come on. And I had used other things, and those other things had brought me down. And I knew there was no question about that I had a problem with them. But I didn't know what an alcoholic was until Joe explained that at step one, and that was October of 1982. I never forget this. And it dawned on me, it says, fool, in my mind, it says, you're alcoholic too. And I remember that at that time, I had another, as people call it, epiphany. It dawned on me, you don't need this stuff. You've just been wanting it. Because I was about a few months dry, you know, from July to October. I was a few months dry. And that dawned on me. And that was the first time I had been dry in my life. And as I go on in my story, you understand that from the age of, I would say, about 12, I never drew actually a sober breath in my life because I always had something in me. And that was even doing the stint in the 70s when I was in the penitentiary, which I'll briefly talk about. Until this day, until that day, I had never been completely and totally sober. And that's when the fog was beginning to clear and I could begin to see such things. Now, my first approach to Alcoholics Anonymous was in 1972. Now, I had been detoxed, but you know, detox is not sober. Detox is dry. You know, and because, you know, you can be dry and you don't have a sober mind. Now, I'd achieved that a few times, but anyway, I got drunk. And that was in the second thing that Joe had said, and that was abnormal. Because most people, when they take their first drink, they don't get drunk. They get tipsy, maybe, you know, but to get knee-walking, throwing up, completely drunk, that's abnormal. So, that's how I started. Well, throughout my life, I could say I was growing up, I was above average in school, and I played athletics, and I had these characters, like in the Big Book, you know, I was, you know, intellectual, and I was also in regards to prideful and. But at the same time, I had some character defects that I was aware of. And my character defects, I can remember back even when I was 6 years old. And I had a lot of fear, had a lot of low self-esteem, had a lot of anger. And these things sort of protruded, you know, in my character as I grew up. And the more that my drinking increased, the more that, you know, these character defects I tried to hide them. And so my drinking and my thinking became the worst part about me. And actually, when I look at it, those were the two things that I held on to, but they were the two things that I had to give up, you know, to be sober. You know, they were the most precious things to me. And as I came through this life in regards to drinking, and my drinking increased throughout junior high school. And I'm not going to go into drunker logs, but I'll just mention a few things. That in our junior high school prom, we sneaked peppermint snaps and put them in the punch. A lot of us, some of us had fun and some of us got drunk. And the ones who got drunk, we tore the water fountain out of the wall and thought it was a great thing. And we just kind of ruined the prom for everybody. And these were capers through all out my life as I was growing up, you know, through my teenage years, and also into my adult years. And everything I did, I would try. I was listening as they were reading. Yeah, I try to control my drinking. You know, I went from I never could drink bourbon, and I went from, you know, trying to drink mixed drinks, you know, never drinking bourbon, went from not drinking liquor to drinking wine and drinking beer. I tried all those things. And one night, I have to mention this caper, I was about 17 years old, and had some girls in the car, which I had to, you know, impress. And I drinking, back in this time, I drank about 18 cans of Tall Boy Slits. You know, they had these tall cans of Slits. I drank about 18 of them. And we were in this car, and I took them over through a hill, what we call, and my car hit the ground, and it tore up the front end, and we were in the air about 20 feet in the air. It left the ground. This old lady come out about 2 in the morning, and she came out with, and to see what all that noise was, that she saw was a bunch of teenagers. And she went back in the house, got a jar of peanut butter and a big tablespoon of peanut butter, and gave me a tablespoon of peanut butter, and told me to swallow it, and she called the police. And peanut butter killed that alcohol smell. Something that I learned back then, you know, good alcoholic. But these were capers all through from the age of 6 up into age of 16. And everything I did, well, I tried to control the consumption of my alcohol. And eventually, you know, after me getting older and grown, you know, like I said, 1972, you know, I was about 21. And, you know, I come, you know, in foul with the law. And I end up, you know, going to penitentiary first time. And so here it was, I was in the penitentiary. And I said to myself, man, how in the hell did you get here? As smart as you were. And I had some time to think. And I was really, really thinking about this thing, because I knew that I belonged there because of what I did, but I knew that I didn't belong there because of the way that I was raised. And because you come in contact with all types of people down there, and you know, some really do need to be there. And I knew that the only reason I was there was because of my addiction. And I said addiction at the time, but at the same time, I said, well, when we get out, I said, we're not going to do this anymore. I said, when we get out, we're just going to stick to, you know, smoking and drinking a little beer and a little wine. We're not going to do the other thing, you know. And so I got out in 1978. This is very, very important, because when I got out in 1978, I was on parole for 5 years, and I remember just getting off parole, which was 1982. Now, this was my second attempt to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. The first attempt, I said, I'm not an alcoholic, and I went to the penitentiary. But this second attempt, I had already been locked up, and I got out. And I remember immediately when I got out, I didn't relapse because I'd never got sober. Some people say, well, you relapsed. No, I never got sober because all while I was in the penitentiary, you know, I was drinking hooch and because I worked in the kitchen, I could, you know, steal sugar and stuff. And, you know, we were making hooch and everything and you know, and smoking pot and everything. So I never was sober even in the penitentiary. So I gets out in 1978 and I barely makes it off parole in 1982. And I never forget this. Because in 1982, about around, I would say March or April of 1982, I was coming to the end of my drink and use. And here it was, as soon as I got off parole, I picked up these new charges. And when I picked up these new charges, the people here in Little Rock, they thought that, they said, well, this guy's incorrigible, you know, and I have to retreat a little bit because the first time I went to the penitentiary, they had labeled me as some type of kingpin, which they do certain people that they want to get off the street, which I wasn't. I was nowhere near that. But they want, you know, label me, and I had about three or four charges. So the second time around, here it is, they want to give me a habitual criminal. That's 21 years plus whatever new charges you get. So at this time in 1982, I was looking at 103 years going back to the penitentiary. Two things that I knew is one that if I went back to the penitentiary, that I would not survive it for one or two reasons. Either I was going to have to kill somebody or somebody was going to kill me. And because after about 5 to 10 years, you get institutionalized, you know, in places like that. So here I am. I got a chance to go in this treatment program. This is where I met my first sponsor. And I go in this program, and I'm in here for a few months. And this is around, you know, April or March, you know, somewhere around in there. And I'm in and out of jail. And so I go back to jail, and I get out of jail about July the 7th. Because I get out of jail July the 1st because I was in detox in July the 4th. And I remember this is very significant. I remember sitting in detox July the 4th, 1982, watching on television, Winthrop Rockefeller had thrown a block party, for the whole city, I mean the complete city, you know, billionaire, and they were serving hot dogs and free beer and parasailing down on Murlock and Dam here in Little Rock. That's on the river. That was our beach. And he's serving this, and this guy was serving free beer, and I'm sitting in detox, I'm watching this. And one side said, man, why don't you go down there and get some of that free beer? I mean, can you believe it? You've never seen anybody give out free beer. And it was unlimited. And then the other side said, yeah, well, what you going to do when it's over? In my mind, just like that, because I knew I had these legal charges looking at me because, and I stayed. So I get out of detox, and I go into treatment, and I get off the bench July the 9th. And that's the day that I took my, even though I was dry, that's the day that I took my sobriety date was July the 9th because that's the first decision that I made, and that was to go to treatment. So I'm in treatment, and I'm looking at all this time, and I got to go to court, And a friend of mine that grew up with me, he was one of the court liaisons. He says, "Man," he says, they want to lock you up, so they're gonna give you a habitual criminal." And so I thought about running, but I didn't. For some reason, I stayed in treatment. I took my chances. And I remember the morning that I go to court, and I had what we would call a chamber trial. That is where we go in the judge's chamber. There's you, the judge, the prosecutor, and whoever support people or attorney if you have. You go in the judge's chambers. They resolve your issue in the judge's chamber. So I'm sitting outside the judge's chambers that day in 1982. And something told me, says, "Man, this is a tough deal, but you've got to face it and quit. You can't run and get this over with, and you got to accept it." So I go in the judge's chambers, and they have this law in Arkansas that says that if you have a prior conviction, that the judge cannot give you a suspended sentence. He have to give you some time. And that's if the prosecuting attorney does not bring up your prior record in court. Well, I'm sitting here in this court, and the judge says, "Larry Gaines, I don't know why that I'm doing this today, but Mr. Richardson thinks you deserve a chance. He says you've never been to treatment before. And you're in treatment now, so," and the prosecutor, he's sitting over there, he's not saying a word. He says, "Now, at the time, I'm on a five-year suspended sentence in another county in the state, and I've got 10 new charges with the feds, he says, "I don't know why that I'm doing this, but I'm going to give you a chance for treatment since you've never had treatment. Mr. Richardson thinks that you would benefit from treatment. And I'm looking at all these charges that you have in previous that you might benefit from treatment." He says, "I'm going to remand you back to this program. But if you leave this program, I'm going to revoke the 5-year suspended sentence you have. I'm going to add another 5-year suspended sentence for escape charges, and then I'm going to call the federal government, and I'm going to ask them to prosecute you to the full extent of the law." And each one of those charges carried about 10 years. So I'm looking at over 103 years in the penitentiary. So I go back to treatment. And I'm in this treatment. And I'm in here for a while. Now, I've already gone through the type of modality that they had in this program in prison, which was transactional analysis. And so I knew that in and out, because I made it out of Cummins, without going back to. So I'm in here for a while, and then the guy pulled me out of treatment, so to speak, and said, "I know what I'm going to do with you." The guy told me, says, "Look, I want you to write me a synopsis." First of all, he took me to a graveyard, and we were at the graveyard, and this guy was a lot through symbolism, and he said, "Now look," he says, "that I am going to give you a chance." He says, "You got one foot in the boat, and you got the other one out." He says, "You got to make a decision today of what you're going to do. Are you going to get in the boat in Naples, Florida, or are you going to get out?" He said, "Before you make that decision," he says, "I will write the courts and tell them that you have completed this program successfully and remove all of that court." If you tell yourself that you would keep that spike out of your arm and won't drink again, and you can stay here with us. But I knew that was my moment of clarity. I knew that if I didn't I knew that if I did not stay in that program, that I was going to recycle my life that day. I knew that. I knew I was safe in those walls. And I knew that if I walked out of there, that I was headed back to the penitentiary. And I didn't want that. So you can say I sort of took step two, walking away from step one. Because I knew my life was unmanageable. And I knew that I needed someone to help me manage it. So I stayed there in the program. And he said, I'm glad you made that decision. He said, now, this is what I want you to do. I want you to write your synopsis on step one and how it reflects your life. I want you to have it on my desk tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock. And I don't want any excuses. He said, if you do, I'm still ask you to take a walk. And we did that through step one, step two, step three. We got to step four. He told me, he says, look, now I want you to go in here. I took steps all the way up to step six or seven within a week. It wasn't no week to do this or day to do this. It was overnight. And if I didn't have my assignment that next morning, the guy would ask me to take a walk. So when I got to step four, he says, listen, I want you to write down everything in your life that you can remember and start back. And this is what I heard. He said, if you leave something out, I'll know it, and I'll still ask you to take a walk. And so I did. Overnight, man, I sat down, and I'll never forget. It was like I went back over my life, and my life was rolling in my head. Because, see, that task that I had to do is that I was trying to save my life. I didn't want to go back to the penitentiary. That's the only thing that I didn't want, is to go back to the penitentiary. I'm not going to tell you I didn't want to quit drinking. I didn't want to go back to the penitentiary. So I wrote down my whole life, and my life was rolling to me like one of these money counters. I swear to you. And it got to this point of this issue in my life, and it says, what about this? And I just went over that issue. And so I met with him the next morning. We sit down. I'm looking at him reading this, and he's saying, you know, this so a lot of low self-esteem, a lot of anger, some resentment, you know, he's pointing out my fourth step, and he said, this is just outright dishonesty and just being a liar. Then he paused. And when he paused, he said, you left something out. And my heart jumped in my throat, and I asked him, I said, man, I said, what if it's something that the statute of limitation doesn't run out on? And he looked at me, he says, man, he says, I'm not the judge. I'm not the jury. He says, I'm here to help you to get free. And we talked about that thing, man. And I swear to you that it was a situation where only God could have relieved me of. And for years, you know, it plagued me, and I thought about it. And I thought it would come back to bite me, but that's why I talk about God being in a person's life, that he orchestrated my life. And so we get through that. But the most remarkable change I could see after doing the fourth step, and we talking that over in the fifth step, and me taking it out into the sixth and seventh step and setting fire and asking God to remove all of those defects of character. The most remarkable change that I could see was when I started on my ninth step. I had harmed people. My family, you know, I didn't have anybody to bring me any care packages, anything. I'd burned every bridge that I had, so to speak, except for the one with God, because he orchestrated me through making these amends. I remember one amends I had to make to this killer that I had taken some drugs from, And I had to go and face this guy and pay him his money. And another, you know, just the means that employers that I work for, I even had to go to Walmart and make amends, attempt to make amends to things that I had stolen out of there. And they told me they didn't have no way to prove it or no way to accept the money. And but you know, and when you make an amends, the man says you be willing to make the amends, because you can't make all of them, and some people not even going to accept, but you got to be willing to face this. And I could see through doing this that I was getting free. I had already gotten free through that thing I talked over with my sponsor. And I can remember, you know, talking to Joe about this, and the only other inventory that I had to do a sexual man with Joe. And I remember sitting down talking with him, and because I've been married for 32 years. And I had to make some men, and Joe would just look at, he would say, man, you leave that woman alone and you work on your life. He said, that's her life. He said, there's no way you can change her. He said, the only thing you can do is change your life. And at that time, needless to say that I didn't know. And I tell you that God orchestrated this. Because at 7 years later, in 1979, I got a full pardon with the order to bear firearms. Because, see, I'd worked for Bill Clinton from 1982 to 1984 when he was getting back in the governorship. And needless to say, this guy, you know, had been watching me, but he gave me a full pardon 7 years later. And at that particular time, needless to say, I know that I was going to need a passport. And so 1979, I, you know, got a full pardon. And then here it is about a few years later, after I closed my business, I have to start traveling for Joe. First time I traveled, he and I went to London in 1994. And needless to say that, you know, this guy and Charlie had traveled all over. Well, I started traveling with him, you know, nationally, you know, in big book cities, you know, Tulsa, Pasadena, you know, Sacramento, and, you know, Harlem, New York, and certain places, you know, just kind of carrying their bags. But I didn't know that I was being prepped to travel the world. The things that just coming to, you know, bringing this thing to a close, you know, to a quick close, is that, you know, in sobriety, of all the people that I have worked with, because I had a treatment facility, my own treatment facility, and I became the director of the sorority house that Joe started, and I can't remember all the places that I've been in cover because of traveling behind Joe and Charlie, but just some of them in Africa, Paris, Germany, Japan, Spain, all over the UK, in recovery. All have been recovery, and I still do. But I'll close and say this. The most remarkable thing is that I've been able to look at my character defects on a daily basis and ask God to keep me humble. And always, I'm 69 years old now with a lot of debilitating illnesses, but I'm still spiritually fit, because I've never stopped working with people, and I've never stopped looking for God in myself and in other people. And that's what sustains me today, is the presence of God. Because in that quest, He has made Himself known to me, and He has shown me that the journey that He took me through was one of such that He had always been with me. And I'll close with that, and I thank you guys for letting me share. Thank you.
Thank you.